After a year living in France, a country with a reputation for its active trade unions and industrial action, I'm back in the UK only to find an ongoing set of strikes of our own.
Workers at 13 train companies have voted to strike, bringing much of the network across the country to a standstill.
This particular dispute is complicated, centres around a specific pay dispute. But one of the points of contention is a suggestion that all ticket offices in the UK should be automated, with obvious redundancies for those who currently work in them. In response to the strikes, the Transport Minister warned the unions that, quote, driverless trains will become more attractive than striking employees, end quote. And in that sense, this dispute is part of a much wider set of changes and conflicts taking place globally in the world of work. A set of conflicts involving workers, capital, and automation. The dominant fear a few years ago was that automation and AI were going to destroy jobs because of the sheer computing power and increasingly broad applicability of techniques of AI, especially machine learning. The result would be humans would be put out of a job and made irrelevant in the labour market. The experts I spoke to about this question all agreed on one thing, that we are not, at the moment, seeing automation leading to mass job destruction. But what we are seeing is AI radically altering the jobs that do exist, creating new models of work. In the process, it is changing societies all across the world. The focus of this series is specifically on how artificial intelligence is changing the labour market and the so-called algorithmic management and gig economy that accompany that. Later episodes will be about a couple of themes. The gig economy in the context of domestic work and in Africa, algorithmic management, and the future of the trade unions. The first two episodes, though, are an introduction. In the second episode, we will zoom in on the experience of workers in the platform economy, looking at how it's organised, how different types of platforms affect workers, and how workers are responding to these challenges on a global scale. In this episode, we take a look at what is happening at the national level, how different political, demographic, and socioeconomic contexts affect changes in the labour market. We will talk to experts on two very different countries, China and South Africa. I spoke to Dr. Jiwei Tian, a labour economist at the National University of Singapore, whose work focuses on China. Just three useful points of context about China before we get into the interview. Firstly is urban labour force. About 60% of the labour force are in urban areas, and the size of the urban labour force is continuing to rise. Running counter to that is ageing. So China's total labour force is actually already falling quite rapidly due to China's ageing society, and obviously that's mostly in rural areas. The final point is that many listeners will think of China as the workshop of the world, but there's actually already a gradual shift from manufacturing to services there. So the number of workers employed in the manufacturing industry decreased by 15% from 2013 to 2018, while the size of the service sector has been rapidly increasing. Just as a final point, we mentioned the Pearl River Delta several times in this interview. The Pearl River Delta is one of southern China's special economic zones, and it includes the cities of Guangzhou and Shenzhen. Here is our interview. Hi, Dr. Tian. Thanks so much for joining us. How is the labor market starting to change in China, and how has it changed due to technology?
Thanks, Paddy. So my pleasure to be here. And in terms of the manufacturing sector, so one of the major issues regarding to technological change is the widely application of industrial robots. If you go to many export-oriented industries, you will find out those industries now have wide application of industrial robots in China, especially in Pearl River Delta and other regions. So that would change the nature of the labor market, because now you have a trend, you know, the robots may replace workers in the warehouse, in the assembly line. So that's one change. Another change, probably you realize in many other countries, the rise of digital platforms. So those digital platforms, firms such as Uber in the United States, provide a lot of new jobs, new types of jobs, gig jobs. The situation is similar in China. So you have many jobs now associated with platforms. You have many people working as delivery men. You have many people working as the DD drivers, drive for the DD platform. And also many people, they supposed to work in the assembly line. Now they are considering platform workers could be another option. So that's another challenge for China's workshop, global workshop status, because many workers now they are considering not working in the warehouse but work as delivery men, which will result in labor shortage issues in the manufacturing sector. Another thing related to this digital platform and technology change is what we just previously discussed about this algorithm governance. So for delivery men, their jobs actually are allocated by software, by a data process. So they are organized by the software, organized by the algorithm. That's something new. With the technology, platform can manage many workers, much larger size compared to normal firms. And so with algorithm, people may have longer working hours. Because now they are working as the gig workers, so they can get tasks at any time from a platform. And another change is the workers themselves, their activities actually bring new data to the digital platform. Delivery men's annual routine activities actually are data points for platforms. So that's something also new. For the labor market.
And what about in terms of automation? In Western countries, we have some people worried that a lot of people are going to be unemployed in the next couple of years because of automation. Do you think that the same worry exists in China, and is it justified?
Yeah, automation certainly is one important issue. As I just mentioned, the innovation is one of the interesting policy areas in China. Governments certainly worry about employment issues, but automations in many ways could bring two issues for employment. One is automation robots may substitute workers. So that's what we observe in some factories in Pearl River Delta. So previously, workers may you need to manage workers by certain, you need to deploy workforce to manage workers, but now if you have an industrial robot, robots will follow certain orders from managers. It's easy to manage. So many firms now they use industrial robots. So in that sense, it could have a substitute effect. But on the other hand, the automation have this complementary effect. For example, digital platforms or digital services, software, they may provide the supplementary support to online education. Teachers' productivity may increase with automation tools. That's one potential issues. But certainly, how to balance those two forces, that's another concern. Which direction of future innovation, how to, you can direct innovation toward those substitutes line, but also you can direct innovation of automation to those complementary line. How to deal with that?
But one of the really interesting things about China in this context relates back to what I said at the beginning about how the labor force is starting to shrink.
Many firms try to replace workers with robots for another reason is to address those labor shortage issues. So if there's no robots, probably it's still very difficult for firms to recruit workers, especially in Pearl River Delta. So in that sense, local government in Peru or Delta, they are supporting automation because the automation can also address these labor shortage issues.
And what about white collar jobs? Are they also under threat from automation?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So white collar jobs, especially these jobs, they are doing routine tasks. Certainly they are under threat. So even you are working in an office, such as accountants, but if your jobs can be managed by industrial software, probably firms may not need so many accountants in the future. So that's a trend. Probably in the future, routine jobs, the demand for routine jobs will decrease. But how to deal with that kind of labor market change? For Chinese governments, I think it's still not so at a policy priority at this moment. My understanding is the government's looking for the digital platforms, new types of economy can bring new employment opportunities from gig economy, for example. So those even you know. The automation or digitalization, new technologies are conceived as the opportunity for Chinese labor market rather than a process where replacing or decreasing jobs in general.
In the context of the Chinese government, are they pushing this? Are they kind of directing investment towards automation? Is it seen as a national security concern as well, making sure that China has technologies which are also then can be used for economic reasons but might also be military?
If you talk to those firms in Peru Delta, they are receiving government subsidies if they purchase industrial robots. So local governments certainly support those automation. So one reason is, as I just mentioned, because of labor shortage. But the other reason is many large warehouse, they are subject to the work injury issues. If you have a lot of workers, there might be some possible risks for accidents, injuries. So if you replace with the robots, local government will have a lower responsibility for, you know, social stability or such things. So that's one issue. The other issue, what you mentioned about those security, national security and those automation, I didn't see evidence in the automation. Basically, is the it certainly is one of the major areas China try to promote. Those automation probably in the future will relate to those indigenous innovation ideas. So because of certain reasons, it's difficult to access foreign technologies in automation. So China has to do that by itself. That could be one angle if you see this from security area. And then after US-China trade war, it's very difficult for China to acquire or merge foreign companies which have expertise in industrial robots or industrial software. So that could be another reason, as you mentioned, China has to develop those technology in the future by itself, because it's difficult to access those technology after the trade war.
One of the kind of the guiding policy of the Xi government is this idea of common prosperity, which most people interpret as like more equality and making sure that everyone benefits from the economic growth. How do you see these technologies impacting inequality in China?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. So I think in recent years, the trend of inequality changed in China, as many countries. Labor income actually accounted for a very large share of inequality in China. So in a recent study, shows that for urban households, 60% of inequality can be explained by wage income difference. So I think the trend of the wage income change can explain a lot about inequality. So the technological change actually can result in those wage income inequality in China. People find out those many technological change, new technology adoption in China are skill biased. So if you have a high education people, university, college educated people, they are more likely to have a high wage premium, which means what you can earn more from new technology. So that's one trend. High college educated people can earn much more under certain types of technological change. That's one issue. A second issue is those with new technology, especially digital technology that I just mentioned, one high skilled people, now they can manage many low skilled people or the they can manage many other people in general with the new digital technology. So which means the high skilled people, they may earn more because they can access larger support from his co-workers. That's the second trend. The third trend is with digital platforms, some people, they have market power, so they can access a national market via digital platforms. Previously, with all those technological changes, probably they can only access to local market. Those workers can access the national market. For example, those people do the direct sale in a live stream at the digital market. So now they can access a nationwide market via those digital platforms. So that's another trend. So people can earn more, especially top 1% people. Their income will increase after digitalization. In general, I think the inequality will be more serious after the automation process.
And what do you think needs to be done in terms of policy? You've written about social insurance and how you think that needs to strengthened in China.
People talk a lot about those vocational education might help to reduce the income inequality, because now you can accumulate human capital for those workers, train them with the new set of skills so they can accommodate those technological change. That's one direction of policy response. The other response is I just mentioned that government can direct innovation direction to different types of automation. Rather than the automation to replace workers, but to automation to complement with the current skills of workers. So that's another policy responses. But the third one, as I just mentioned, transfer programs. If you have a transfer programs to support low-income people, to support people who suffered adverse shocks from labor markets, such as unemployment insurance. So those social insurance certainly could be useful, especially for those digital platform workers, delivery men, because they have they are exposed to risks such as the traffic accident. They need to work a long time and they need to travel commuting to deliver food. So those people, they might need to have work injury insurance to make sure they are protected financially if there is any traffic accidents, so on and so forth. So social insurance certainly will be important to protect those people financially. But the current situation is the social insurance, as I just mentioned, unemployment insurance is supposed to be important, but the coverage currently is pretty low. Many people, they are not covered by unemployment insurance. And also the digital platform workers, delivery men, they are supposed to be as many other countries, they are supposed to be independent contractors rather than employees of the platforms. So those people, they don't have protections from social insurance, such as the work injury insurance. So the protection of delivery men, digital platform workers, should be strengthened. My understanding is currently the Chinese government has started to work on this social insurance protection for platform workers. So hopefully we can see changes in the next few months or next year, before next year.
And one of the policy responses a lot of people were discussing, so in Western countries certainly, there was a candidate who ran in the US for the presidential election in 2020 on this platform, was about a universal basic income. Can you see that happening in China? Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, I think UBI, this universal basic income, certainly could be one important policy responses to technological change. In many countries, it's a way to encourage people spend some time to learn new skills, accumulate human capital, and also they don't need to suffer from adverse shocks from their financial status. So I think that in general, this is a good idea. But regarding to implementation, there are still many issues to be settled. In many countries, the major concern probably is the public finance, how much government has to spend on these kind of programs. The other concern is the coordination between UBI and the existing social protection programs. That's another issue. A third issue is whether there will be any moral hazard. If people receive universal basic income, whether the labor participation rate will change after this. So I think that's a major issues. But for China, I think currently, China still wait to build up the very basic social insurance. Even unemployment insurance, the coverage is very low. I'm not sure whether China still are ready to have another social insurance. Currently, even for current set of social insurance, the bureaucrats have difficulties. They don't have enough capacity. They don't have enough resources to manage those social insurance. I'm not sure in China, UBI will be a quick solution. My expectation is what China is going to do is to fine-tuning current system before adopt this UBI.
And just one final question. A lot of people talk about these platforms as being very kind of, they centralize a lot of information, which is what people don't like about them. They're very quote unquote communist because of it. Is this something that you can see the Chinese government making more use of these systems? I mean, especially in terms of automation, you mentioned that they don't have the capacity to increase unemployment insurance, but potentially if they automated some bureaucratic functions, maybe they could.
So many people now in China talk about this smart city, digital twin cities. A key idea is to, if you don't have enough capacity to deal with the city management, probably you can digitalize it. Computer system can anticipate what kind of things you could do in the next stage. So you can have different types of algorithms, machine learning algorithms to anticipate or predict what kind of risks, what kind of issues will be happening in a smart city. I think that's what close to what you just mentioned is more government can have a more centralized management of information, data, and also resource allocation. Yeah, I think that's the trend, but the issue is to achieve that, you have something basic to be done. Firstly, you need a data format which is unified across bureaucratic departments. So one department's data format should be recognized by another department's. So that this is something China still need to be done. And even in the top level state council meeting, it was mentioned that the information silo within bureaucracy still prevailing in China. So data format is the one issue. People don't understand each other's data format. Second issue is the whether people willing to share data. Especially when you have a platforms, the data basically highly relate to platforms commercial interest. So platforms, even they have deployed many sensors, the platforms, they have many real data, spatial data from delivery men or taxi drivers. But those data have huge financial values for platforms, whether they are willing to share with other people is another issue. So the centralization might to address those data sharing issues also. So the besides the data format and the data sharing, in the future, China currently highlights this importance of data infrastructure. So 5G infrastructures, cloud computing, those things can certainly help for to centralize data and control many facilities, equipment, machines, sensors. So that those things could be one trend, data infrastructure. But certainly, my understanding is that it's still far from have a fully picture of a really digital twin city at this moment, given those issues I just mentioned. So it's still a long way to go.
So we can see how China's aging population is actually partly driving automation of certain types of jobs, especially when some people are moving from working in industrial sectors to jobs in the gig economy. And we'll come back to this issue of the gig economy in later episodes. For now, we're going to compare what we've just seen with South Africa, which is a country with a young, growing workforce and a GDP per capita of just under $7,000, according to the World Bank. So that's about half the figure for China. Here is Professor Imran Velodia, a Pro Vice Chancellor at the University of Witwatersrand and the Director of the Southern Center for Inequality Studies. So we're going to go on to talk about your work in a second, but I just wanted to discuss the context we're talking about here. Because you research the impact of AI on jobs in Southern Africa, and you've written that there's little evidence that there will be widespread job destruction in Southern Africa. But where are we at in terms of this research in this area? Because there's a lot of research about the impact of AI in richer countries in terms of job destruction, but what about in Southern Africa?
Yeah, so just to kind of clear things up, I think my view would be that the kind of whole debate about the fourth industrial revolution and its impact on employment is not taking sufficient account of the realities in the global south, and that much of the work and the thinking is kind of approaching the problem very much from the perspective of the global north. And I think if you're in the kind of global north, you might take the approach of saying that job destruction kind of related to AI and more generally related to the fourth industrial revolution is not such a big problem, because you kind of have the resources in the global north to kind of deal with that problem through the welfare system. You know, so there's kind of arguments like the basic income grant that can basically pay everyone a wage, and we don't have to work. I think our view would be that that sort of approach doesn't take any account of the realities of countries in the global south. So, for example, we live in a country in South Africa that already has unemployment of about 35 to 45%, depending on how you define it. You live in a society in South Africa, and I would venture in many other parts of the global south, the public resources that you have for kind of dealing with job destruction is not as large as you have in the global north. You're also living in a context where large proportions of the workforce are working in the informal economy, earning really, really low levels of wages. So I think it would be kind of incorrect to say that I'm not concerned about kind of issues of job destruction. I am especially concerned about that, because I think the nature of that job destruction and the possible ways in which we could deal with it are not the same in the global south as they are in the global north.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, the way that I looked at it was in terms of the phrasing of that problem kind of implies that you have really well-defined kind of 9-to-5 jobs, which just isn't really true if you have a very informal kind of based economy. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, let's take a sort of country like India, you know, you have something like 80% of the workforce that's working in the informal economy. There's also particular gender patterns to that. You know, you have much more female work occurring in the informal economy, and I think if you don't bring that kind of into the world that you see, then you're not making a complete assessment of what the likely impact of the fourth industrial revolution might be. And it's kind of really with that in mind that we've started in our inequality center a kind of fairly long-term project that's doing work across a number of countries in the global south to try to assess what is actually going on in kind of labor markets in the global south. So we're doing work in kind of South Africa, Mozambique, Ethiopia, kind of Brazil, Colombia, among others, and kind of trying to understand what these impacts are in countries in the global south.
And do we have any sense yet how much kind of job destruction, if we can call it that, is going to take place, or is it just too early in the research to say?
I think I would say it's much too early for us to kind of put any numbers to it. But also we're not really all that focused on a quantification of the problem. We want to take a much more complex look at what is actually happening. So, to sort of give you something of a feel for it. So, in what ways are kind of new platforms kind of impacting on kind of regulatory systems in countries such as South Africa and countries such as India? In what ways are kind of artificial in what they think about management oversight of that sort? In what ways do the workers respond to this? So it's the kind of quantification is just one small part of the issues that we're interested in.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So we're going to go on to talk about this impact of what you mentioned, the term the fourth industrial revolution. Could you just clarify what that means for us specifically?
Yeah, so it would kind of involve a set of new technologies that are based on kind of artificial intelligence, digital processes, new forms of kind of how we think about data, that are all coming together to change to kind of change the nature of kind of production and change the nature of the way in which we work. Lots of it is about technologies that are kind of based on kind of robotics, on kind of artificial intelligence, and new forms of kind of how we use some of these technologies. So I'd see all of that coming together, kind of into something that's been called the fourth industrial revolution. But I think it would be fair to say that the term is kind of open to a lot of debate. I think there's a lot of social science that is concerned about the lack of clarity, the lack of kind of specificity about exactly what it is we're referring to.
Okay, that makes sense. So just in this context of new technologies relating to artificial intelligence, for example, in, say, a South African context or the context of other developing countries, do you think this is going to be kind of negative for inequality? I know that's a very broad question.
Yeah, look, I think the kind of evidence would be that without some changes in policies, that the kind of effects are kind of substantially increasing levels of inequality. And I would say that for two reasons. The first is that it's quite clear that the kind of economic benefits of these sorts of technologies kind of accrue disproportionately to capital, and they kind of accrue disproportionately to kind of owners of large stocks of wealth. So we have wealth inequality rising, and we have the power of capital in relation to labor kind of rising, and I think those two factors are really driving a process of inequality which is kind of throwing up some absolutely remarkable levels of inequality across the globe, something that we haven't seen for a long, long time.
So does this vary significantly between workers in different kinds of industries?
Yeah, look, I think it's still sort of early to tell, or it's kind of early to tell for sure, because I think the technologies are kind of evolving, and we kind of living through a period of quite fast and widespread technical change. But I think what it is doing is kind of undermining kind of regulatory systems that are in the labor market to kind of protect people at the bottom end of the income distribution. So if you take, for example, the kind of Uberization of work, or you take the kind of growth of kind of platforms, what those are doing is so fundamentally changing the employment relationship that I think the kind of traditional system that is based on an employer and an employee having power relationships that are skewed in the interest of the employer, and lots of labor market regulations try to kind of change that balance. When you don't have clear employment relationships, it's much harder to kind of enforce some of those regulations. So I think we are seeing negative consequences, especially for those who tend to have fairly low incomes and tend to be in kind of jobs that in the past were kind of protected by regulations. I think some of these developments are so fundamentally kind of centralizing power, for example, in platforms, that kind of informal producers, for example, who might have been supplying to kind of retailers in the past, now have a lot less power. Not that they had much in the past, but now they have a lot less when they're supplying to platforms. So that's another example of vulnerable groups that are being disadvantaged. But I do think that there's also something in the types of technologies that we likely to see some quite significant impacts in kind of higher paid sectors of the economy. So in kind of sectors that we think of traditionally as skilled and high paid, so lots of professional jobs. Take the case of the legal profession, or the auditor's profession. I think some of these changes in technology are having quite substantial impacts in those areas as well.
And just with this example you used of Uberization and the kind of relationships not being very well defined, is that just a problem of regulation just regulation needing to update itself? So for example, in the UK recently there was a case which means that Uber drivers are now defined as employees rather than, I think they were contractors before. Can we solve this problem just by properly defining the new power, like employee relationships, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's much more complicated than that. So I think dealing with the regulation issue is and kind of clarifying the employment relationship is one important step. But to go back to the Uber example, the nature of the pricing system involved and the technologies involved in that pricing are all not at all transparent to the workers. So you've fundamentally changed those sort of power relationships. Larger questions about monitoring of workers, I think issues of kind of how data is used and kind of who owns that data, etc., are kind of quite important kind of issues that we're going to have to address as this process plays out. I think the questions of kind of the role of social policies and how we deal with it are another set of issues that I think we need to think about.
So you touched on briefly this idea of gender inequalities in your first answer. How do you see that developing in terms of this context of the fourth industrial revolution?
Yeah, I'd say a few things. So one is we've not seen, but I think we will see. We kind of starting to see kind of changes in the way that care occupations work. So kind of healthcare, kind of social care, domestic care, etc., are kind of sectors of the economy which are disproportionately kind of employing female workers. I don't think that the kind of impacts in that area of kind of services have been as strong as say certain male sectors like the transport sector. But I expect that those processes will kind of play out. And I think that depending on kind of how these technologies evolve, depending on what the regulatory systems are, I think we could have some quite substantially negative gender impacts that would flow from it. I think it's also important to say that there's the potential for kind of some amount of emancipatory kind of elements as well. But I think overwhelmingly, I would think about it as the those at the lower end of kind of the income of the income distribution would tend proportionately to be largely female, feel the negative effects first, feel the negative effects more kind of strongly, but it's also groups that are less kind of able to deal with some of these shocks. And I think that's an important issue as well.
And then there's just two more issues that I'd like to pick up on, especially in an African context. We're talking about a much more rural-based society, certainly a lot more urban than it used to be, especially in the last 20 years. But we've still got an ongoing process of rural to urban migration. How do you see that playing out in terms of the differences? And can you see it kind of accelerating it? Do you think there'll be more jobs in cities? What do you think is going to happen there?
Yeah, it's a tough task to kind of gaze into the future. I think it's quite clear that these technologies are having important effects on the way in which kind of agricultural production happens, and I think it's also having quite big impacts on the food chain much more broadly in terms of the prices that come to farmers, the kind of prices rural kind of small scale farming enterprises would earn for their activities, and that the kind of platform economy, the kind of concentration of power at the top end of that system, I think will have quite negative impacts on people in rural areas. But again, the technologies also have the capability to kind of bring people who were previously marginalized a lot more from kind of from cities kind of a lot more closer to the mainstream of the economic system. So in some ways those trends would benefit people. I think specifically to your question about whether urbanization rates would kind of increase or not, it does seem to me Africa's kind of urbanizing at a tremendous rate, and the expectation is that process will sort of continue. I think while these technologies have the potential to kind of reduce space, I think it will drive the urbanization process even faster, because you would that closing of space is going to make cities a lot more, or the kind of advantages of cities vis-a-vis the rural areas a lot more to the advantage of cities. So I would think that's the likely impact we'll see.
So then, just as a very, very broad question, what should policymakers be trying to do?
So I think on the kind of employment side, I think the kind of regulatory frameworks have to change to find more creative ways to protect people at the bottom end of the distribution. But I think that these are kind of tech sort of driven processes, and I think the fact of the matter is that technology is kind of actually driven a lot by public subsidies, and I think governments have a lot more scope to shape the kind of impacts of technology than what a mainstream view would suggest. There's a view that technology has something that is inevitable about it, and something that we have no power over. I would question both of those. I think because they largely publicly financed, notwithstanding the fact that they now largely in private hands, but the kind of essence of the science of it is kind of publicly funded, that governments need to shape the kind of social impacts of technology a lot more, and I would argue that we have a lot more control over those processes.
And do you think that's because especially in an African context, a lot of these technologies come from outside? I mean, they come from Western countries, especially Silicon Valley. I mean, how do you see that playing into this? Do you think it's about developing African homegrown technologies in response?
I would think some of it is, but I also think we need to think about democratization of that kind of scientific process. You know, the reality is that if you're thinking about this in terms of kind of inequality between the global north and the global south, the kind of global north has a lot more power kind of over those processes, not because the kind of global north is smarter about developing these. It's kind of really because of the inequalities in resources between the global north and the global south. And I think for that reason, scientific research between institutions in the north and the south has to both be increased, but also has to be much more democratic, and also much more kind of equitably financed than how it's happening at the moment.
And then, just as one final question, as a broad question, there are two really important points of context which have just been lurking in the background here. One of them is the fact that Africa has the world's fastest growing population, has a very young population, and it needs to create a lot of economic opportunities to keep up with that. The second is obviously climate change, which disproportionately affects Africa. And you can see both of those having a real impact in the context of technology on the political processes in different African countries. What do you see happening, especially in democracies like South Africa?
I think climate change is a fundamental sort of game changer in these processes. So the kind of reality of the climate problem is that we live in a world where part of the world has kind of too much and has kind of overexploited the physical environment, has used a set of kind of energy technologies that has kind of created led to great harm for the entire globe. The kind of solutions to that, it seems to me, have to be linked back to inequality. It's kind of in everyone's interest that if we have a more equitable world. I think the kind of challenges of climate and the challenges of kind of dealing with AI and the fourth industrial revolution can be made a lot easier than kind of if we're dealing with those problems in a world that is inequitable. And here I'm thinking about inequality both between countries and also inequality kind of inside countries. So I think if we're going to solve both of those problems, we're going to have to think about difficult questions of the sort of costs of what has happened for the last few hundreds of years, the damages that is imposing on kind of groups across the world disproportionately, and how we're going to deal with the compensation for those damages. And it's exactly the same sort of challenge on the tech side. So if we want to manage these transitions in a way that's going to be sustainable, I think we have to be thinking about doing them in a way which deals with inequality.
This theme of inequality is something we will keep coming back to in this series, especially in our later episodes on the gig economy for domestic workers in the UK and for drivers in Africa. In our next episode, we'll be looking at the impact of the platform economy on workers and how they respond to this. If you enjoyed the episode today, we'd be really grateful if you could leave us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast or recommend it to friends or on social media. It would really help us out. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.